I have proven that in a remote antiquity, there was in the plain of Troy a large city destroyed of old by a fearful catastrophe, which had on the hill of Hisarlik only its Acropolis, with its temples and a few other large edifices to the south and west on the site of the later Ilium, and that consequently this city answers perfectly to the Homeric description of the sacred site of Ilios. So wrote Heinrich Schliemann, one of the first excavators of the site now generally believed to be the city of Troy that figures so prominently in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. After 140 years or so of digging, what have archaeologists discovered at Troy? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is the University of the Year.
How closely does the site in western Turkey match Homer's description of it? As archaeological techniques become more sophisticated, what have we learned about the rise and fall of the legendary city? And what are archaeologists hoping to find there today? Our guest is William Elward, professor of classics at the UW-Madison and organizer of the latest expedition to Troy.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I know we're going to be talking about your exciting upcoming expedition in July and August to Troy to do some new digging and find answers, hopefully, to some new questions. But before we talk about that, can you take us back to just sort of the beginnings here and tell us what's real about the city of Troy? How much of it is just sort of legend from these ancient Greek epics? How much appears to be a historical reality?
Well, I think that the quotation from Schliemann, read moments ago, is very accurate. It's an accurate portrayal of what we know about the archaeological site now and what Heinrich Schliemann knew about the archaeological site when he began his excavations there in 1870. Schliemann, of course, went to the site with a shovel in one hand and the Iliad in the other hand.
Don't forget the dynamite. And
trying to prove the historicity of the Trojan War. And many have followed in his footsteps trying to prove the historicity of this, of the Homeric epics. That continues to capture the imagination of archaeologists and classicists alike. Schliemann was engaged in excavations at the site for about 20 years in fits and starts, and he made remarkable discoveries. And he concluded that this was the site to be connected to the Homeric legends. One of the challenges for archaeologists in Schliemann's age and down to the present day is that no writing has been found at the citadel. Writing, of course, is of profound consequence for Bronze Age civilizations of the Mycenaeans to the west and of the Hittite civilization to the east. Contemporary with the heyday of Troy, these civilizations preserve evidence of writing, treaties with foreign parties, agreements, and archives of palace commodities that help us understand the lifeways of the inhabitants of these places. At Troy, no such evidence has been found, and until it's found, but of course it might not exist at all, the gap between archaeology and myth probably will remain irreconcilable. And that's not a bad thing, because we know that the Homeric poems were written for entertainment. When they were first committed to text in the 8th century BC, they were so performed, and in the centuries before that moment, when they were communicated orally, it was entertainment that was the focus, not historical writing.
But it was a culture that was, or a site that was in between two literate cultures, and yet there's not a scrap, not a word of writing in the whole place. And this we're talking about over the course of hundreds and hundreds of years.
Well, the archaeological site has only been excavated here and there. Only about 10% of the site has been excavated. So much of the site remains to be explored. Schliemann thought that the citadel was it. We now know, based on discoveries in the 1990s, that there was an enormous lower town. The citadel covers about 6 acres, but we now know that a lower city covers about 50 acres, and that this was probably inhabited in the Bronze Age. We know for sure it was inhabited in the Hellenistic period and in the Roman period. But this has transformed our understanding of the citadel. New places to explore have come to light, and writing could still be found.
Just based on the 10% that has been discovered so far, what can we say about Troy?
We can say that in prehistory, what we call the Bronze Age for this part of the world, between about 3100 BC and 1200 BC, the city rose to great power, very close to the Hellespont, the very important single waterway that connects the Black Sea with the Mediterranean, so of profound consequence for maritime trade and military security, a flashpoint for conflict throughout the ages. Think about the Gallipoli campaign of 1915. This citadel rose to great power and prominence because of its topographical setting and because it was positioned between these two superpowers in the second millennium BC, the Mycenaeans in the west and the Hittites in the east. It was perhaps a vassal kingdom of the Hittites. One single piece of writing that has been found at Troy, dating to what we call the Troy 7b period, so very, very late, very, very end of the prehistoric period, includes Luwian hieroglyphics. This is sort of a Western dialect of the Hittite script. So based on a single find, it's a small bronze seal that was worn by an individual, perhaps taken to the site, perhaps by someone who lived at the site. We know that there was a Hittite connection, but that piece of writing is too small to say, to make large conclusions about what was going on at the site. We know that the citadel was sacked in the 3rd millennium BC and at the end of the 2nd millennium BC. We know that the site was sacked. It was probably sacked continually throughout prehistory. From the archaeological evidence recovered from the site, conflagrations, burnt mud brick layers, and collapse and burn layers, and abandonment. At the end of the Bronze Age, shortly after 1200 BC, the site was abandoned, and the prehistoric inhabitants never return. So something of consequence occurred. And this fits with the general pattern that even the ancient Greeks tried to rationalize for the story of Troy. Herodotus tried to rationalize the story of the Trojan War in the 5th century BC, and he was much closer to the events in question than we are today. He suggested that that Xerxes' invasion of Greece in 480 BC was payback for the Trojan War. Thucydides rationalized the story by suggesting that it was understandable that it took the Greeks 10 years to sack the city because of the supply chain that a foreign army would have required. Eratosthenes of Cyrene and the Marmor Parium provide suggestions for hard and fast absolute dates for the Trojan War. So all of this evidence combined suggests that there was an attack of the city and that the city collapsed and burned and the population was captured or forced out sometime at the end of the Bronze Age. And the archaeological evidence suggests this took place around shortly after 1200 BC.
So roughly the time that Homer would be referring to.
Correct.
We'll just call it Troy henceforth. We'll go on that assumption. It's not right on the Dardanelles, though. It's not right on the water. It's removed by several miles.
Is that 5 kilometers.
Is that just because that's where the nearest good, solid hill would be to build with for security reasons?
At the time the very first settlement occurred, the sea was right at the base of the foothills.
It was.
Yes. The Scamander and the Simois rivers water the plain, and deltaic progradation and alluvial deposits over the centuries have now pushed the coastline out 5 kilometers from the city. So the original disposition of the settlement was designed to be connected to the sea.
And so if we're talking again about the Iliad, they're sailing right up to Troy.
One of our research questions that we're taking on is trying to identify the ancient harbors around the city. Some of these might be off the western coast of the Aegean, which was protected by a rocky coastline, which was not affected by this deltaic progradation. But geomorphological studies over the past 20 years at Troy, conducted by Professor Ilhan Kayan at Ege University in Izmir, have shown that have allowed for a reconstruction of the paleotopography and have shown that there was a very large inlet off of the Dardanelles that came right up to the city of Troy. And this explains the foundation of the settlement there in the early Bronze Age.
You're quoted in an article that I read as saying, Troy is a touchstone of Western civilization. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. This, of course, has to do with the Homeric stories. The epics written down in the 8th century BC were probably communicated orally over generations, many generations, probably going back to some sort of kernel of truth involving an expedition against an eastern citadel by a western power. These types of stories aren't invented. It's too complex. There must be something at the beginning that provides the basis for the story, later embellished for purposes of entertainment. Homer is central for Western education, translated into Latin sometime in the 3rd century BC, central for the ancients, teaching and learning of ancient Greek amongst the Greeks themselves and by Romans later on in the age of the Roman Empire. Homer was central for education and thought and learning.
So if there was no Homer, would there be even any interest in this site?
That's an excellent question. The site is a substantial ruin. It has remarkable fortification walls, 12 feet thick, over 30 feet tall, solid interlocking limestone masonry, unique among fortification systems in the Aegean world. We know of no other fortification system like this across all of Anatolia, across all of ancient Greece. The Hittite civilization had a different defensive architecture, and the Mycenaeans had a different defensive architecture. So the citadel itself, just looking at the archaeological evidence alone, is unique and is worthy of study and would probably have a place in the literature, but absolutely not the place that it has now because of its connection to the Homeric stories.
Is there a sense that the impressive walls you describe were knocked down from the outside or somehow breached?
Well, it only takes one gate.
That's right.
To
one
to
gate,
be opened,
one horse.
to take a city. So any attackers in the ancient world were only interested in breaching the walls at one particular location. So the walls are intact. The parts that have been discovered are intact. But let me clarify. The western gate on the citadel was destroyed in an earthquake that brought an end to what we call the Troy 6 Citadel sometime in the 15th century BC, and it was filled in, blocked up, probably because the citadel went into a phase of withdrawal when it was rebuilding from the earthquake damage. And Carl Blagan's excavations in the 1930s were key for identifying the earthquake collapse that brought the citadel, parts of the citadel wall down shortly after 1500 BC. And the citadel was refortified, but then taken probably by human agency. Again, it's the excavations of Blagan, but also the excavations led by Manfred Korfmann from the University of Tübingen in the 1990s that provided additional evidence for sack of the city by human agency.
And does Turkey own this sort of area now and put some pretty clear restrictions on what you can do?
Sure. All archaeological sites in Turkey are controlled by the Ministry of Culture and Tourism, and foreigners are allowed to conduct excavations and to partner with local authorities for excavations on these monuments. And the sites and all the artifacts that come from the sites, of course, belong to the Republic of Turkey. And we work very closely with a local museum. Every region of Turkey has a local archaeological museum that is responsible for managing the finds from all the sites in that region. So we work very closely with the Çanakkale Archaeology Museum for storage and management of the archaeological finds. It just so happens that they're building a brand new museum at Troy. They're probably going to break ground on construction before the end of the year. And this will bring new attention to the site, bring more tourists to the site. About 500,000 tourists per year visit these days, but that number will increase. They've broadened the highway to a new 4-lane highway to provide access to this area of the country. And we also work very closely with a representative from the Ministry of Culture and Tourism who comes to the expedition, who lives with us in the camp and sort of supervises our research. So we're very close ties and important connections with the Republic of Turkey because we are their guests.
This site has really traditionally been pointed out, hasn't it, as Homer's Troy? I mean, even before anybody had done any digging for centuries, it seems to have been the assumption that this was the place.
That's right. The geographies of Strabo and other writers in the classical period suggested as much, and identification in the 18th century and later Schliemann's excavations in the 1870s were preceded by a very important character for the history of the site, Frank Calvert, a British consular agent living in the area who conducted the first excavations at the site and was very influential in Schliemann's concept of the site as Homer's Troy.
And it was Schliemann found, though he even by excavating a very small part of this site, because you say, what, it's like 90% untouched at this point or something
like that?
That's
a rough estimate, yes.
So I mean, if we're talking 1870, Schliemann, despite using dynamite in some instances to speed things up, still found in that small area remarkable stuff.
Schliemann's finds are no doubt remarkable. And they provided the first glimpse of this fascinating prehistoric civilization. And they continue to be of great consequence today for understanding the prehistory of Western Anatolia on the border with Aegean civilizations. So, yes.
Tell us about the treasure.
Well, Priam's treasure. In 1863, allegedly, just outside of the southwestern gate of the citadel we call the Troy II Citadel, this was the citadel that had its heyday in the middle of the 3rd millennium BC, there was a cache of gold and silver objects, mostly vessels, but also jewelry, found by Schliemann. And it was sort of sequestered away and hidden away, but then sensationalized and put before the press as a very important discovery. And some of it was taken to Istanbul. Much of it was taken to Berlin. And then in 1945, when the Russians captured Berlin, they found some of the treasures and lots of other things too and removed them to the Pushkin Museum.
Was Schliemann hoping to find, you know, the Trojan horse and some things that he never found?
Certainly. Schliemann was trying to prove the historicity of the Trojan War. He was reading the Iliad very carefully and looking for evidence and correspondence between the text and the archaeological site, no doubt about it.
What kinds of things besides a Trojan horse would have been referred to in the epics that an archaeologist would be looking for specifically?
The names of the gates for the cities, the number of gates, the names of the gates, the disposition of the gates, the description of the gates. A lot of action takes place on the walls and at the gates in some of the duels, for example. Descriptions of the palaces, the Megaron Hall, the palaces of King Priam and others. So those types of things. And some of the accoutrements of the warriors, the descriptions of arms and armor, for example, are important. The boar's tusk helmet is a type of helmet mentioned by Homer, and that's one very important correspondence between the archaeological record and the Homeric epics. The best evidence for the boar's tusk helmet mentioned by Homer and worn by elite warriors comes from Greek archaeological sites, contemporary with Bronze Age Troy, where we have very, very good examples of these types of helmets. So there are important archaeological connections between the text and the archaeological record.
Human remains found that would tell some of the story as to what happened to Troy?
That's a wonderful question, a very important question. In Blagan's excavations in the 1930s, when he made very important claims based on sound evidence for the fall of the city after the earthquake and in the final collapse of the city, his descriptions do not include any evidence for human remains. Perhaps because of the particular locations where he was digging, perhaps because later inhabitants or survivors of these cataclysmic events recovered the dead. Very, very scrappy evidence for human remains from the citadel itself. So if they were skirmishing in the street and people were killed, we don't have evidence for that.
No animal remains either?
Many, many animal remains from
eaten animals?
From evidence of butchered animals and animals, animal sacrifice and animals that were consumed by the inhabitants. All sorts of animal skeletal remains survive at the site.
What about any religious icons or temple-looking things?
From prehistory, very difficult to identify, very difficult to identify. Even in archaeological sites in Greece and Anatolia, religion is something that's very difficult to surmise about archaeological remains in the absence of written evidence, which suggests that such a place or stone could have been used as an altar. At Troy, it was the belief of Manfred Korfmann, the organizer of the expedition from the University of Tübingen, which began in 1988 in partnership with the University of Cincinnati, but just recently came to an end in 2012. And by the way, Manfred Korfmann passed away in 2005. But in his excavations in the 1990s and his interpretation of some of the configurations of the gates, he suggested that pillars which stood before the gate were markers that had religious significance to sort of ward off evil spirits, and that they were connected with Apollo and perhaps Poseidon, but more Apollo, because these deities are mentioned in the legends as having lent a hand in the construction of the citadel walls of Troy, but not a lot of evidence for religion in prehistoric times. We have quite a lot of evidence for religion in the from the Greek period and the Roman period when the site was resettled following the 8th century BC by different inhabitants.
We'll dig more deeply into Troy and find out more about the latest discoveries when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest William Elward, and he is telling us about the latest excavations at Troy. It's a site that you're actually sort of the gatekeeper at this point, aren't you, for excavations at Troy?
For foreign collaborations, that is true. I'm working very closely with a local partner, Professor Rustem Aslan at Çanakkale Onsek İzmit University in Çanakkale. Çanakkale is the major city near Troy, about 100,000 people with an important university. And Dr. Aslan will hold the license issued by the Republic of Turkey, but the University of Wisconsin is the exclusive international research partner with access to the remains.
Should I ask how we got the scoop?
I began my association with the project as a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati. The University of Cincinnati embarked on an expedition to Troy in the 1930s with Carl Blagan, and then in 1988, a partnership with the University of Tübingen. And in that partnership, the University of Tübingen in Germany was the leading institution. That partnership ended in 2012. I began working at Troy in 1996 as a graduate student pursuing my PhD, which I earned in 2000 from the University of Cincinnati in classical archaeology, and I've continued my association with the site, returning every summer to the site of Troy to conduct research and to bring Wisconsin students. In 2002, I brought my first Wisconsin student to Troy, and in 2008, and ever since, I've been bringing Wisconsin students to Troy. And when the Tübingen-Cincinnati partnership ended in 2012, there were discussions among the partners and stakeholders in the expedition to Troy, and from those discussions, the University of Wisconsin partnership with Çanakkale University emerged, and we have an agreement to allow Wisconsin exclusive access to the site beginning in 2013, and we expect a 10 to 15 year engagement in Turkey at Troy.
Wow, well, that's really exciting.
A job like that. We've been talking about the citadel, and that's obviously just one small but, I gather, prominent part of this whole area, Troy. So what would you expect to find, or what kind of buildings in the citadel itself, and then what do you speculate might be in the surrounding area?
There's so much to find at Troy. The site was founded on a very tip, the last little tip of the foothills that slope down from the Ida Mountains in the middle of what we call the Troad on the Biga Peninsula, which juts out into the Aegean and connects the Aegean with central Anatolia. It was the prehistoric citadel involved concentric walled fortresses beginning about 3100 BC in phases identified by Schliemann and later his assistant Dirpfeld, Wilhelm Dirpfeld, who excavated at the site between 1893 and 1894, with six iterations of a Bronze Age citadel. And the largest topographical extent was reached at the end of the second millennium BC, between about 1500 and 1200 BC. This is what we call the Troy 6 and 7 phase. And this citadel encloses an area of about 6 acres, high stone fortification walls all around, systems of gates and towers, and palaces inside. We have quite a lot of evidence for the palatial buildings inside the walls that are just inside the fortification system. In the middle of this oval-shaped fortified enclosure, we have very little evidence. for Bronze Age inhabitation. If Priam ever had a palace on the summit of the citadel, it does not survive because the summit and interior of this oval-shaped enclosure was destroyed by Hellenistic and Roman builders who made the place their home following a phase of resettlement beginning in the 8th century BC. And they flattened out the top of the mound to build a courtyard for a monumental marble temple of Athena built in the 3rd century BC. And they pushed all the detritus and remains of the Bronze Age citadel off the edge. But in doing so, they covered up everything on the periphery quite well and preserved it so that we can find it today. And Schliemann's excavations and all the excavations which have played out at the site to date have focused on these areas and have come up with two- and three-story buildings with sizable stone foundations, wooden rooftops, tile roofs, facilities for food storage inside, latrines, paved stone walkways and streets and alleys with underground drain systems to drain effluent out beyond the walls. So they had sophisticated hydraulics and groundwater wells.
Many
groundwater wells. It's a karstic bedrock that is beneath the citadel, and water flows down through bedrock channels in this system of bedrock.
And they bring them up.
And they tunneled down into the bedrock and brought the water up in groundwater well systems.
What can you tell about the class system, you know, in terms of upper class, lower class, different kinds of dwellings that would suggest some had more than others?
Absolutely. This was the case. We know there must have been some class divisions because of the striking difference between the inhabited zone on the citadel and the lower town. The lower town was also fortified, but to a lesser extent. There was a ditch and palisade system. This involved a deep ditch cut into the bedrock, enclosing an area about 50 acres in size, and we've found archaeological evidence for the ditch and palisade system. This was a remarkable discovery organized by Manfred Korfmann in the mid-1990s and initially discovered in a system of fluxgate cesium magnetometry, a ground-penetrating radar system or remote sensing system able to perceive structures and features between 2 and 3 meters below ground level, brought evidence of a massive structure across the plateau to the south of the city to light, and test excavations show that this was a ditch and palisade system, and it was built to protect something inside. What was that something? Probably people. The architectural remains in this zone are very elusive, and it's been suggested that the buildings in this zone were made out of ephemeral materials and materials that don't survive well in the archaeological record. But to organize and to construct such a system of defenses suggests that there was something important to protect there. So people and animals, for sure.
Do we find, just to kind of pull back a little bit, do we find other cities of Troy's vintage in the vicinity that were equally destroyed by earthquake or human agency?
In the immediate vicinity, no. Troy is sort of a singular find in this area. Now, of course, when one looks further west and one looks further east, the Hittite palace at Hattusha, the Mycenaean palaces of Mycenae and Tiryns and Pylos in Greece, and Hattusha in central Anatolia, these were destroyed right about the same time that Troy was destroyed. And this is a mystery that continues to occupy the minds of scholars of Aegean
destroyed
prehistory.
Destroyed how?
Well, this
is the mystery.
Some were destroyed in conflagrations, and others perhaps in phases of abandonment, earthquake collapse. Mm-hmm. There are a variety of interpretations, economic collapse, famine, class revolt, have all been suggested. Marauders from the sea, pirates attacking coastal cities. Most of these are coastal places. Hattusha is not, but the cities in Greece are coastal palaces. So this is a mystery. The collapse and the end of the Aegean Bronze Age is something that has not been explained satisfactorily, and research continues to explain the widespread abandonment and collapse of civilizations. And Troy is among the important citadels.
So if you head out in a few weeks for this expedition, tell us sort of what it is that in your wildest dreams you're hoping to find out there.
There's so much that we hope to find. Some of the important research questions that we will engage involve excavations on the Citadel to continue the quest for the discovery of writing, because writing from the Bronze Age will transform our understanding of the archaeological site, the way that the elites live their lives at Troy, the writing system of the Trojans, the language of the Trojans. We don't know the language of the Trojans. In Homer, everyone speaks Greek.
A sort of very literal question, but you're there and you're trying to get more evidence from the Citadel. Is it a careful, very tedious kind of sifting
winnowing
through?
And sifting.
Yeah. I mean, what literally do you do there?
Well, the excavations involve removal of fill from deposits, from between walls, from trenches that are defined in locations that we select based on past discoveries, adjacent discoveries, interconnections between standing remains and deposits that are accessible to archaeologists. Remote sensing techniques provide some indication of what's beneath the ground.
Shovels?
All of these. When the excavations begin, yes, we use shovels and trowels and brushes and brooms. The fill is sifted, and in many cases, closed deposits are filtered through flotation systems to bring charcoal and charred seeds and other remains that would be missed by the human eye when traveling through soil to light, so that we can save them and preserve them.
You have to catalog everything and plot its exact position.
Recording. So much of what we do is about recording. We have one chance. Archaeology is destructive. We can't put the fill back and do it again. We have one try, one chance to get it right. So everything we do is focused on recording, photography, drawing, GPS systems, and...
Yeah, and is there evidence that's sort of at the molecular level? I mean, do you take some of it and do a lot of microscopic, you know, looking at it, or MRIs, or I don't know what the word is, but something that would show you the particles?
Archaeological science is very important for the archaeological program at Troy. We're embarking on a science program that involves molecular archaeology, looking at samples that are taken from human skeletal remains, animal skeletal remains, seeds, and plant remains that are detectable in the archaeological record. And we're engaging laboratory scientists here at UW-Madison and internationally to embark on a program of molecular archaeology, which will add a new layer of data, a new layer of information to what we already know about Troy. There's a substantial amount of information we already know about Troy. The new excavations are very likely to recover the same categories of artifacts that have been found by the previous excavations. The same types of ceramics, the same types of terracotta figurines, the same types of graves, the same types of stone remains. What hasn't been conducted in the past are investigations at the molecular level. So this is where the new UW-Madison expedition hopes to make a real contribution. By tapping into the talent and know-how and resources and instrumentation here on campus, and to embark in partnerships with universities in Turkey for the exchange of materials and talent to investigate Troy at the molecular level. So much can be learned about the paleopathology of the ancient Trojans, the lifeways of the ancient Trojans, the diet of the ancient Trojans, the ecosystem that provided food supply for the Citadel of Troy, the ways that they lived and died, and these are of great interest to us.
I suppose you could learn, if you had any kind of remains, where they came from. In other words, we just assume that everybody in Troy was born there, lived their whole life there, and died there, whereas if it was such a crossroads, there presumably were people from all over the place in Troy.
That's right, and we know very little about the identity of the ancient Trojans. So studies that can focus on the mobility of human populations, animal populations, in this age of prehistoric civilization at a very important location between Mesopotamia and Europe. Troy was right on one of the important crossing points between Mesopotamia, Anatolia, and Europe. The Hellespont was traversed by armies of Xerxes invading Greece in 480, armies of Alexander the Great attacking the Persians beginning in 334 BC. The Byzantine emperors crossed routinely on pontoons. All of these crossings were on pontoons stretched out across the Dardanelles.
Really?
And this was a crossroads between Europe and Mesopotamia. The identity of the people who lived at Troy, where they came from, how they communicated with people beyond the Citadel is of great interest to the new expedition, and the past archaeological interventions at the site have been able to say very little about this. So we're hoping to engage in a molecular archaeology program that involves ancient DNA studies and proteomic studies and ways to tap into pathogens such as Mycobacterium tuberculosis, for example, and others that provide evidence for life and death at the site of Troy.
I suppose you'll find all kinds of history of medicine ideas there as well. How much farther will you extend the perimeter? In other words, you're talking about sort of continuing to look at the citadel, but how much wider will the diameter be once you get through?
Yes, this is an important question. The site of Troy was transformed into a national park by Manfred Korfmann in the 1990s, and this provides a very robust buffer zone around the site and protects the landscape from building. The area around Troy is visited by very many tourists. It's a popular tourist destination, holiday villages and hotels nearby. So this national park designation provides some protection for the site, and it will allow us to develop programs to expand our investigations of Troy into the hinterland. One of the important discoveries we hope to make beyond the citadel involves cemeteries. The cemetery where the royal elite of Bronze Age Troy has not been discovered yet. It must be somewhere. It's waiting to be found. It could be 2, 3, 5, 10 kilometers away from the city. The dead were always buried beyond the city walls. The cemetery of the Hellenistic period, the cemetery of the Imperial Roman period, when there may have been up to 20,000 inhabitants at the site, on the citadel, then the Acropolis, and the lower town. These discoveries have not been made, and new scientific techniques, new laboratory techniques for investigating and extracting and understanding the genome of the ancients will be very important research that will advance our understanding of the archaeological site. But also, we hope that such discoveries will also inform medicine and science in the present day and inform how we understand bacteria, for example, in the future.
Have you found the dump yet? Have you found a good dumping place? If you've come up with a lot of bones, usually they aren't they kind of dumped over a wall somewhere?
You're referring to animal bones. Mm-hmm. The minute you put a shovel in the ground at Troy, you find animal bones. Animal bones are everywhere.
Oh, they just threw them everywhere, huh?
yes, animal bones are everywhere at the archaeological site. And the very same types of ancient DNA studies that I discussed in terms of the human remains, we also hope to conduct on animal remains and learn about the evolution of life, humans, animals, and plants at Troy over almost 5,000 years of uninterrupted settlement history. That's why these types of laboratory techniques that we're hoping to bring to Troy are important for this particular archaeological site, because Troy, unlike other archaeological sites in the area, has almost 5,000 years of uninterrupted settlement history from the very, very early Bronze Age, 3100 BC, down through the Byzantine Emperor until about 1200, 1300 AD. Other archaeological sites have a prehistoric phase or a Roman phase or a Greek phase, but not all the phases, one on top of the next.
We have that
at Troy.
And how accurate is the dating, the carbon dating that everybody sort of hears about? Have there been advances in that so that you can really pinpoint the year of something?
Absolutely. The technology is used widely, and depending on the state of preservation and the type of sample, dating within a century is certainly possible, and more refined work down to a couple of decades. So we rely on those types of techniques for dating and synchronisms in the archaeological record, synchronisms with other archaeological sites, and just fundamental stratigraphy.
I've heard somewhere that the Greeks, or at least Greek warriors, shunned the idea of eating anything other than beef. Is there any indication that Troy, among all those bones, that was the diet of choice for those who could afford it? Or what did Trojans eat, so far as we can tell from all those animal bones?
Sure, they certainly ate beef, but they also ate a lot of fish.
Yeah, it would make sense.
We know they ate a lot of fish. We know that fish was a staple in the diet, and we know that fish were readily available in the Aegean. And we know that they had sophisticated techniques for catching the fish. Tuna fish bones have been found, and you can't haul in a tuna from shore. You have to go out in a boat to get it with sophisticated nets.
Yes.
So we know that they consumed a lot of fish. But we know from the historical period, later literary sources, that cattle were commonplace and consumed by the inhabitants of Troy. The most famous story involves Xerxes arriving at Troy on his expedition to invade Greece in 480 BC and being welcomed by the inhabitants of the site, who told him about the stories of Priam and Achilles and Hector, gave him a tour of the place, and then 1,000 cattle were sacrificed. It's obviously hyperbole, but there must be some truth to it, and they were drawn from the hinterland. They were drawn from the villages, drawn from the towns, probably to feed the army of Xerxes. So we know that this was a staple in the diet.
Sheep
in
also,
the historical period.
I would think.
Absolutely.
Chickens?
Yes. Fowl, we also have evidence. We also have evidence for fowl.
Now, do you see evidence of dogs?
Yes, we have evidence for dogs. Our best evidence for pets, per se, is from art, prehistoric art, which shows, especially Egyptian civilization, which shows cats and dogs and birds and such in domestic context. So we know that in prehistory, pets were known. And also from the Homeric stories, the dogs who nibbled on the crumbs that fell beneath the table of Achilles and Patroclus, for example, are mentioned.
More on Troy when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is William Award, and we're talking about his upcoming expedition to Troy to engage in more archaeological digs. What does Troy mean to you? I'm just curious. You've been there many times. You're about to go again. What does it mean, sort of on a personal or emotional level, that site?
Troy is a very special place. It's a mysterious landscape. When you're there, you feel the importance of the place, its connection to the sea, its connection to Anatolia, its connection to Greece, and its connection to Homer and Western art and literature and stories that have captured the imagination of civilization across the ages. I started working at Troy in 1996 as a student, and Troy, to me, means and provides an opportunity for me to train students in the same way that I was trained in archaeological field methods, techniques. I have been very much engaged in training students from Wisconsin, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison at Troy. I took my first student there in 2002, and I've been taking students ever since. Being able to train students, provide firsthand opportunities at a very unique resource for cultural heritage and science is of great interest to me, and I'm just overjoyed that I have the chance to provide this opportunity for students at the university to partake in these excavations.
And what sort of partners are going to be there with you for this upcoming expedition?
We have some very important partners, and I'm very glad for the chance to talk about them. They've been very, very supportive, and I'm just thrilled at ways that this new expedition has taken shape. Most important is the Biotechnology Center here at the university. Dr. Mike Sussman, the director of the Biotechnology Center, has provided space, laboratory space, scientists, instrumentation for proteomics and ancient DNA studies. This is key to the success of our archaeological science program, and investigators in the Biotechnology Center, like Greg Barrett-Wilt, the director of the proteomics facility, have visited Troy. Last summer, they came to conduct some reconnaissance and think about research questions. So that's been very, very instrumental to the formulation of our ongoing expedition. Other researchers on campus involve faculty from bacteriology, from geography and soils, from medical microbiology and immunology, and anthropology, classics. I'm in the classics department. So the expedition is an interdisciplinary venture that draws on talent from science and from the humanities in ways that are very important for understanding what archaeology is and the potential of archaeology for bringing these disciplines together. Internationally, we also have a very important collaboration with Hacettepe University in Ankara for ancient DNA studies and studies that we hope to conduct on animal and human skeletal remains from Troy, but also other archaeological sites in Turkey. And I'm also engaged in a collaboration with the Institute of Nautical Archaeology, currently based at Texas A&M university, and they are going to embark on a search for an ancient shipwreck off the coast of Turkey. This is very, very exciting.
There must be plenty of them.
There must be plenty of them. The Dardanelles are the entryway to the Black Sea from the Mediterranean, and we know that ships were moving through this area all the time. And the discovery of a shipwreck off the coast of Troy would transform our understanding of the archaeological site. But the potential to compare a cargo from a shipwreck off the coast with the artifactual remains at the site would help us understand connections between the terrestrial environment and the maritime economy of this area. So I'm very excited about the shipwreck survey that's going to take place this summer with our partners at Texas A&M University, led by the director there, Dr. Deborah Carlson.
How do they go about that if you can't just, send divers down every 25 yards?
Well, they actually do that.
Do they?
Yes, but they also have sophisticated sonar and submersible.
And that's not been done in that area at all? No shipwrecks yet?
Not in a systematic archaeological way. Of course, divers and sort of ad hoc explorations go on all the time, but a systematic archaeological survey that is recorded and conducted in a very organized fashion has not been conducted off the western coast. There are very important waterways, protected waterways. There's a bay off the western coast of Turkey, about 5 kilometers from Troy, called Beshik Bay. It's a very safe anchorage for ships moving into the Dardanelles. And the island of Tenedos is just offshore. And the channel between Tenedos and the mainland is an important channel where we might search for shipwrecks.
What other technologies are going to be tried that haven't been done before?
One important technology that archaeologists are using more and more every day is 3D imaging technology for recording the remains. Recording is central to what we do. We're only there at the archaeological site for a limited number of weeks every summer, so we have to work very carefully, very fast, because we don't have access to all of the discoveries in subsequent seasons. They are housed in museums, and we return to the archaeological site to make new discoveries. So new technologies which involve three-dimensional capture, video and photographic capture, involving sophisticated cameras that are emerging on the market, it seems every week or month, are going to be deployed at Troy for capturing objects. And this doesn't only involve recording, but it also involves interpretation, our ability to interpret the objects and compare them with objects, join objects to connect breaks between objects, for example, with this 3D technology is very important for archaeological interpretation. Another technology that we hope to deploy, this is a brand new idea, an emerging idea, but I hope that we're able to tap into it, is something that involves cosmic ray muons. I have an emerging partnership with Professor Duncan Carlsmith in the Department of Physics here on campus to investigate deploying cosmic ray muon detectors at Troy. These are cosmic particles that are able to be captured by sophisticated detectors. 10,000 cosmic ray muons per minute impact the Earth, every square meter of the Earth, and they can be captured and recorded, and they pass through rock. So one of the imaging technologies that we hope to use at Troy is our cosmic ray muon detectors to map the bedrock, the rock beneath the city, perforated by groundwater wells. We know that there was a cave system beneath part of the lower city that had a groundwater river that was tapped by the ancients. So this technology would provide a brand new image of the site and would propel our understanding of the archaeological site by leaps and bounds, because we would know where all of the groundwater wells were located and extensions to the cave system. And these systems were used by the Trojans to enhance their quality of life at the city.
Is the groundwater still there?
Absolutely.
They didn't drink at all?
The groundwater is still there.
If I were to go to Troy today, what would I see just lying around on the surface? What would it look like?
Well, you would approach the city from the north, and you'd be able to see it as you drove down from the Dardanelles, down from Çanakkale. You'd see the rise in the topography. Off on the western coast, you'd see earthen mounds, the alleged burial places of Ajax and Hector, rising in the topography. They still stand there today. Excavations have shown that they were built in the historical period, some of them, probably by Greek and Roman inhabitants keen on keeping the legends alive. they made their living off of Trojan legend. Tourists visited the site in antiquity.
Sort of a theme park. Uh-huh.
Caesar was there. Augustus visited. Roman emperors Hadrian and Caracalla. Constantine thought about founding his new eastern capital at Troy before he went on to Byzantium and then Constantinople. So the place was very important for visitors. And I've already mentioned visits by Xerxes and Alexander the Great. So you would be traversing this topography that these important historical figures before had traversed. You would come upon the citadel and you would make your way in through the modern tourist entrance. First, you would see a very large wooden horse, which was built in the 1960s by the Çanakkale Archaeology Museum to promote tourism. And immediately upon entering the archaeological site, you would be faced with a massive citadel wall of the Troy VI period, which rises 20 to 30 feet off of the ground. And you will walk right in front of the tower, right around the walls of Troy, through the gates and the towers, inside the citadel, up onto the Acropolis, later built by the Greeks and Romans, to see the foundations of a monumental temple in marble, celebrating Athena, the cult of Athena Ilias, the protectress of the city in the Greek and Roman times. Then you would walk through a sort of a garden of marble architectural parts left over from Schliemann's excavations of the temple of Athena. And you'd walk around the northern part of the site, around to the west, to the so-called Scaean Gate, and look out across the plain of Troy, out to the Dardanelles. And below the walls on the western side of the citadel, you would see a large sanctuary built in Greek and Roman times to celebrate the goddess Cybele, or the Magna Mater, a cult very important for Anatolia, but also for Rome. Rome imported this cult in the Hannibalic War at the end of the 3rd century BC as a talismanic device to protect the city from Hannibal. This was an important cult celebrated at Troy, and very important for Ilion's connections to Rome. Of course, Rome has two important foundation stories, one involving Romulus and Remus, descended from Mars, the other involving Aeneas, descended from Venus Aphrodite, Aeneas the Trojan hero, who escaped from the burning citadel of Troy and made his way across the Mediterranean to found the Roman line, so told in Virgil's epic poem, The Aeneid. So Rome's connections to Ilion's connections to Rome were substantial in the historical period, and the cult of Cybele celebrated in Roman times in the western part of the city was key for this. You would then move around to the southern part of the city, making your way back to the tourist entrance, and you would see a Roman odeon or small theater built in the Roman imperial period, but probably a place where poetry was performed, the epics were performed for an audience of about 1,000 people. The auditorium had about a capacity of about 1,000. You'd pass by a Hellenistic gymnasium transformed into a Roman steam bath, and then you would pass by the Greek council house. The city of Ilion was made to be the capital city of a federation of towns all across the Troad in the late 4th, early 3rd century BC. So it was a very important political power, a very important religious power for the entire hinterland that we call the Troad. And then you'd make your way into parts of the lower city and then finish up the tour. It takes about 2 hours to walk through the ruin.
And perhaps in 10 years, the tour will take a lot longer if you continue to find things. Best of luck on this exciting upcoming excavation.
Thanks so much. It's been great to be here to share this information with you.
Our guest has been William Aylward. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.